pollution so that, ordinance so that a person in his motel, would have the right to complain about, the leakage of sound coming from an establishment, even next door. What we're talking about is really a situation where people are, enjoying the phenomenon of a musical performance, and whether you or I, appreciate it in the same way that the patrons of the establishments do is really neither here nor there. We assume that they're there on a voluntary basis. Complaints from employees are virtually nil. I have no members of mine that have ever complained about the sound level in the bands and the music in which they're performing, the music of the bands in which they're performing. However, they do complain about the tobacco smoke level, and when they have had the temerity to complain, and we've reported it to DEQ, it's been reported back that the smoke levels are entirely admissible. Although my members do complain about eyes getting red and watering and their throats getting dry when they're trying to sing. I don't think that anybody is going to advocate the ban on selling of smoking tobacco, nor are we going to go back to prohibition. And again, I submit that these three activities go on in the same locations night after night. You lost your chance back about 1970 when we allowed music in taverns. And our local, if some of you have been around, was instrumental, pardon the pun, instrumental in getting live music in taverns, and we wouldn't, and we'd fight anybody who wanted to take it out again. We do agree that we need an educational program. I think Senator Timms expressed himself very well on this regard, and we would certainly not hesitate to help disseminate information not only to our members but to others regarding this. We're not against good health, but I think what you're talking about is going to be virtually unenforceable. People are going to listen where they won't. They don't want high sound levels, noise again, unwanted sound, on their job, working in their workplace of work. Those same people, for whatever reason, are going to enjoy music at a certain sound level in their recreational hours, and whether they listen to it individually or whether they listen to it in groups. I think there are alternatives to people who don't want to frequent those establishments. I think there are establishments that provide music, live and otherwise, at lower decibel levels. And again, the person always has the opportunity to turn around and walk out if he or she doesn't like the style of music or the sound level of the music in which it is. Another phenomena of our time, along with loud music, I heard Mr. Roy complain that you can't carry on a conversation. I submit again that that's one of the reasons to have loud music, so you don't have to converse with anybody. And I think seems to be a phenomenon of our time. I'm not agreeing with it, nor am I advocating non-conversation. But the people, again, who frequent these places enjoy the music, and they enjoy the ambiance, if you will, of the establishments that that have music on various sound levels. Again, our concern, and I've been facetious a couple of times just to bring a point, but our concern is that it's not that we want to see no guidelines, but we want them to be reasonable guidelines that's not going to imperil employment by professional musicians in this area.
Mr. Finley, what kind of music do your members play? Do you play classical or do you play modern music? Or ultra-modern music?
We play all kinds.
You classical, play rock and roll
I don't play rock and roll, no. But we have many members who do. And top 40, middle of the road, country western, country rock. You name it, we have members who perform it.
If you play, you belong to the union.
Well, you mentioned Beethoven's symphony being high also. It just seems to me the impression is it's always the rock and roll music that is always the highest and the loudest.
I think very likely that what we're talking about is for sustained levels of time. And in that particular case, there are certain types. And, you know, various people mean various things when you talk about rock. Some people are talking about so-called AM rock, top 40 rock. Others are talking about acid rock, which was popular a few years ago, punk rock. I mean, there are a lot of different types of, there's even soft rock. I think what we're talking about in general is a sound level which is approaching what Dr. Vernon was talking about, 110 to 116 decibels. And I think what we're talking about is the sustaining of that level over a period of time, and various people are affected different ways. We recognize this. We don't, however, want the whatever regulations are promulgated, either here in the legislature or administratively. You know, I'm always a little leery of administrative rule because we've run into some other problems in other departments with that when it would appear that somebody's reading into something that perhaps the legislature didn't originally mean. And we don't want to, this type of thing, we don't want to become so restrictive that it's going to prohibit a lot of performances which would otherwise probably go unnoticed from a sound standpoint.
I'm sure the legislation here is to educate and to promote the importance of not having too high a level while still enjoy the music at the same time.
Merely a comment. When we used to have the old, the little trills in the clubs and things, they were not amplified. I think it's amplified music. You have the
everybody's
not a regular piano anymore. It has to be amplified.
That's right. Everybody's amplified now, Senator.
When the other music didn't wasn't that objectionable, and it was loud, but not at the same tone level that you would get now.
Well, I think it's a, I think again, as Dr. Vernon indicated, it's a fad. It's a sign of our times. It's a phenomenon that goes along with a lot of other things, and you can draw some interesting interesting conclusions to this. When I first started out as a field representative for my local a number of years ago, I'd go to some of these clubs and it'd be very loud, and I'd start to fall asleep. It affected me just the opposite as it did. I didn't want to get up and move, but a lot of people seem to find it stimulating.
But I agree with you about the conversation. You know what I mean? It's the cool jazz. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Any other word you talk to them, you know what I mean?
If there are no further questions, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Jim Moran.
The young kids would do without that expression anymore.
Obviously, Mr. Moran isn't here. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 626? Okay, if not, this concludes hearing on Senate Bill 626. Do you want to read the workers' compensation bill? The committee member has all a letter from workers' compensation department regarding the noise level.
Which is the next one?
So just want to call your attention to it so you all read.
House Bill 2093. 2093.
Mm-hmm. Now we're going to have a hearing on House Bill 2093. Marsha, will you go over House Bill 2093 with the committee, please?
Yes, House Bill 2093 is a sunset bill, and it proposes to make several changes in the present laws pertaining to tax service examiners. Section 1 is the section that continues the State Board of Tax Service Examiners and the licensing of both tax consultants and tax preparers for 8 more years. A tax consultant is a person who can contract with a member of the public, and a tax preparer is a person who works on tax returns but does not contract with a member of the public, works instead for a tax consultant. There are several changes in regulations governing tax consultants and tax preparers, and I've prepared a section-by-section analysis for members of the committee. Is it the chair's pleasure that I go through each section, or?
I don't believe it's necessary. We are going to have witnesses that will go through the bill in more detail. Let's see, the first one on the witness is Mr. Bob Grunstead from Legislative Research.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bob Grunstead. I'm from Legislative Research, and was one of the people responsible for the sunset report relating to the State Board of Tax Service Examiners. This board was established in 1973 to license persons who, on a commercial basis, prepare, assist taxpayers with the preparation of personal income tax returns. I think there are only a few comments that are necessary regarding, by way of background, for House Bill 2093, which would reestablish the board. First is that this board regulates only two of the various groups that provide tax services. The regulated groups are the so-called commercial tax preparers and also enrolled agents, which are also regulated by the IRS. A second point to make is that the board regulates only the preparation of personal income tax returns, and therefore is not concerned with people who prepare partnership returns or corporate income tax returns. Whether tax preparers should be regulated was an issue in the early 1970s, and laws were eventually enacted by Congress and by two states, Oregon and California. Very briefly, the federal law requires tax preparers to maintain certain records, to sign and place identification numbers on all returns prepared, and it subjects tax preparers to civil penalties for such offenses as negligence in preparing a return. The Oregon law requires tax preparers to pass an examination and be licensed. California has no examination, but it does require tax preparers to be registered and to meet certain education requirements. Under the Oregon law, there are two types of licenses, one for tax preparers and one for tax consultants. The primary distinction between the two is that a tax preparer may only work under tax consultant supervision, and only a consultant may offer his or her services to the public. There are about 4,000 tax consultants and tax preparers in Oregon. To become a tax preparer, a person must complete a 60-hour basic course in personal income tax law and pass a written examination. To become a tax consultant, a person must work 2 years as a tax preparer and pass a more difficult exam. Both licensees must meet an annual 20-hour continuing education requirement. The board is composed of 5 licensed tax consultants. Major activities of the board include the processing of consumer complaints and enforcement actions against licensees and unlicensed persons. Also, since no other states license tax preparers, the board must prepare its own examinations. House Bill 2093, as amended, would make the following major changes in the tax preparers law. It would add 2 members to the board, including 1 public member. It would change the appointing authority for board members from the Director of Commerce to the Governor, subject to Senate confirmation. It would require applicants who are enrolled agents to also take an exam on Oregon tax laws. Currently, enrolled agents are exempt from examination requirements because they have already passed a rigorous written examination that's administered by the Internal Revenue Service. The final major change would allow the board to use revenues collected from civil penalties in carrying out the law. Currently, civil penalties are now deposited in the state general fund. That's a brief summary, and I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Bob, when you say 60 hours of base education and 20 hours of continuing education, does that mean, how many terms of schooling does that mean?
Madam Chair, I believe these are special courses. They can be offered by community colleges or business colleges, and also large firms like H&R Block have their own special in-house courses. And so they're not structured according to semesters or quarters. They're special terms, and they must be at least 60 hours long. They must meet an outline for material that's been developed by the board.
So 60 hours doesn't mean 60 credit hours. 60 hours means actual time taken.
I believe that's correct.
In those courses. Mm-hmm. So it could be a week and a half if a person takes 8 hours a day.
It could be, I believe.
But that's not a credit hour.
It's my understanding that the course must last at least 60 hours.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think no other states license tax preparers and tax consultants?
Madam Chair, the issue was a major issue back in the early 1970s, and there was a lot of publicity about problems in the tax service industry. Oregon and California went ahead in 1973, enacted licensing laws. Perhaps other states haven't enacted laws because Congress in 1976 did enact special regulations for tax preparers. In the Sunset Report, I think we note about six states that we are aware of that have considered legislation, but I don't believe that it is an issue now, and perhaps it's because the federal government has taken some role in regulation.
So they are under federal regulations?
There are certain federal regulations. They require the taxpayer to sign returns, to keep records of the returns, that you have to keep a copy of the return for a certain period of time. And then there are civil penalties for negligence, or if a tax preparer negotiates a taxpayer's refund check. And so there are certain consumer protections of that nature. But there are no federal, examination requirements or any kind of licensing requirement.
You mentioned that this is for personal income tax returns only and does not include partnership and corporate income tax returns.
That's correct. Or gift tax returns, estate taxes, or anything. Only the personal income tax.
Do you think that should be included?
That question has been raised in the previous hearings. Since it is a consumer protection type law, I believe that's probably the primary reason it's been limited to only personal income tax returns, whereas corporate income tax would affect businesses and other entities that we have generally maintained can or have the resources to defend themselves, whereas the consumer with a personal income tax return may need state protection make sure that the service is competent and correct.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Truly.
Eleanor Blundell, Administrator for Board of Tax Service Examiners. Is Eleanor Blundell here?
Madam Chairperson, I'm Ivan Boyer, our Vice Chairman, and I will come up with him to answer any questions that you may.
Okay.
I didn't hear what she said. I was talking to John.
Will you identify yourself for the record, please?
Madam Chairperson, members of the committee, my name is Ivan Hoyer. I'm a tax consultant and vice chairman of the Board of Tax Service Examiners. I think before we begin, at the point of clarification, since these hearings have begun in our legislative process, that has been determined that our board does find itself governing the elements of the preparation of estate income tax returns and partnerships. The only area really that we don't control is that of corporation at this point. House Bill 2093, specifically related to the continuance of the Board of Tax Service Examiners, was recommended by the 61st Oregon Legislative Sunset Review Committee for passage, and the Oregon House has passed this bill. We have organized our information to attempt to answer your questions and provide basic background information concerning the board and its operations for you. I believe a little background information would be appropriate. It is interesting to note that the commercial preparation of income tax returns has been done far longer in Oregon than most people realize, and it became really important after World War II when the tax laws began to proliferate. During the following years, the only licensing agency in the state of Oregon was the State Board of Accountancy, which controls public accountants and certified public accountants. In 1953, the Oregon legislature created a new tier of licensing administered by the State Board of Accountancy, with those licensees called public accountants. In 1973, the Oregon legislature established the Oregon Board of Tax Service Examiners, which was charged with examining and licensing and the continuing regulation of those individuals preparing personal income tax returns for the public for a fee. A strong classroom and continuing education program was authorized and has been implemented by 12 out of the 13 community colleges within the state of Oregon.
Is everybody foreign?
These colleges incidentally offer student courses in tax preparation using instructional manuals prepared by qualified practitioners under the sponsorship of the State Department of Education and with the approval of the Board of Tax Service Examiners. And speaking of classroom hours, we require 60 hours of education. However, many of these institutions do have classroom course credit for these particular tax courses. We have two state associations that have developed continuing education programs, along with a number of private sponsors, and continuing education, which is practically non-existent in outlying areas prior to the licensing requirement, is now made available to all practitioners. In 1982, the provisions of the Oregon Sunset Review Act caused the State Board of Tax Service Examiners to come under scrutiny of the Oregon legislative process. As a result of this examination, House Bill 2093 has been framed as it has been outlined to you today. Since 1973, the number of tax returns prepared in the state of Oregon by all licensed practitioners has appreciably increased. The Oregon Department of Revenue indicates that more than 64%, and really closer to 70%, of all tax returns filed have been prepared by one or more of the licensed practitioners in the state. Now, this means that over 750,000 personal returns were prepared by licensed licensees in the state of Oregon during this last filing season. Many of those, of course, have been licensed by the Board of Tax Service Examiners. The expertise of the licensees regulated by the Oregon Board of Tax Service Examiners become more important when we realize that the Internal Revenue Service has begun to phase out its taxpayer assistance program, and it has now almost been completely discontinued. The Oregon Department of Revenue also has reduced its taxpayer service program. Thus, the importance of knowledgeable, trained, and disciplined tax preparers has become more important as these years progress. In 1983, for example, we're faced with a brand new tax law, this time named after a lady, for example, Greta, which would be the General Revenue Enhancement Tax Act of 1983. Again, we go through the educational process with our preparers under the licensing law. And we ask just how well prepared are licensed tax preparers. I can answer this by stating that there was a popular assumption in the mid-70s that only certified accountants and tax attorneys were capable of preparing adequate income tax returns. A study conducted by the General Accounting Office of the United States government revealed that returns prepared by commercial preparers and also by attorneys and CPAs and PAs rather over the nation were about equal in the number of errors. The study also found that errors made by commercial preparers as compared to certified preparers appeared on returns generally in the same places and were often made for the same reasons. Regardless of this information that was revealed by the study, Congress passed Preparers Penalty Act of 1976, establishing certain federal requirements regarding the preparation of income tax returns and applying this to all income tax practitioners in the United States. This includes licensed tax consultants, preparers in Oregon, attorneys, CPAs, PAs, anywhere in the nation. In the meantime, the Oregon State Board of Tax Service Examiners has been flexing its own muscles, supervising commercial preparers in our own state. Its objective was to provide relief for the taxpayer from unscrupulous practitioners, establish educational criteria to raise the level of knowledge and the ability of practitioners, and to provide a source of relief from indiscriminate practices of certain elements of the profession. These regulations are somewhat different from those that have been promulgated by Congress under the Preparers Penalty Act of 1976. It can be shown by statistics since the licensing law has been in existence that the board has received a total of over 1,000 consumer complaints. Between 1973 and 1975, the board received only 84 consumer complaints. In the next 2 years, as we became better known, the number rose to 225. And the highest number is in the biennium of 1977 through 79, and has declined appreciably since those years, as the effect of the disciplinary action of the board has been taking effect on the practitioners in protecting the interests of the Oregon taxpaying consumer. Of the 1,000 complaints to the board, letters of warning to licensees and non-licensees alike total over 363. There have been 31 letters of reprimand issued by the board. More severely, 57 civil penalties have been assessed, 58 now, resulting in fines totaling nearly $20,000. Six licenses have been denied through the board's pre-licensing screening process, and 9 licenses have been suspended, and 7 licenses have been revoked. Administrative hearings have been conducted for 33 cases. Some action beneficial to the consumer has been taken by the board or its administrative and investigative staff in each one of those more than 1,000 complaints made by the public. It is a belief of the board that even though perfection in action is always sought, it is not always achieved. We hope that fairness, compassion, and considered evaluation of all information provided by the board has led to equitable decisions in the majority of the complaints heard.
We're trying to get him in.
It has in some quarters been stated that licensing law came into being simply to legislatively place a stamp of professionalism on the business of preparing tax returns, and that there was a fear the licensing law would promote a closed shop situation for those practitioners already in the business. It's been my knowledge that although the licensing law may have helped enhance the professional appearance of tax preparers, the profession itself has already achieved professional status in the eyes of the public really long before the licensing law became possibility. It can also be shown that far from fostering a closed business climate in Oregon as it once was a concern, quite the contrary has occurred. In that properly educated and tested practitioners are entering the field in increasing numbers each year. Today there are 4,000 licensed tax consultants and preparers in the state of Oregon. There were only a little over 1,900 licensed in the first year of the law. I believe it is reasonable to state that increasing complexity of federal and state of Oregon income tax laws are creating a situation whereby even some of the more simple returns may run afoul of the prolific number of rules and regulations imposed by the governmental agencies to collect more and more taxes. And, of course, this becomes more important since the Oregon has chosen to disconnect from the federal law, which was voted in by the people in 1969. In the future, many more returns will be prepared by licensed tax consultants and preparers who are striving even now to keep abreast of the increasing volume of tax law legislation being rained upon us all, and almost on a daily basis. And even the Internal Revenue Services responded by asking Congress if they couldn't stop a while and let them assimilate what they've already got. The Internal Revenue Service has also attempted to evaluate the performance of tax preparers in Oregon. A study prepared under the supervision of the Internal Revenue Service and submitted to the Oregon Sunset Review Committee on October 12th of last year reveals that all of the third-party prepared returns, those prepared by Oregon practitioners, averaged an accuracy rate of 97.2500%. Those prepared by taxpayers achieved an accuracy rate of only 85%. In addition to these statistics, Mr. Jerry Huntley, field representative for our board, is furnished with a list of assessments made against Oregon tax practitioners by the Internal Revenue Service under the provisions of the Preparers Penalty Act of 1976. Mr. Huntley receives a copy similar to that received by the tax practitioner noting that particular assessment. Mr. Huntley has informed the members of the board that roughly 90% of the